Welcome to Rowan Radio 89.7 WGLS FM, our special presentation, Lucky Man, an interview with Greg Lake of Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Welcome, Greg. Thank you for being with us.
Hi, Craig. It's my pleasure.
It's indeed our privilege to speak with such an accomplished musician over the last 40 years in the genre of progressive rock and other things as well. Can you tell us a little bit about how you started out in music as a youngster?
Well, I started playing guitar at the age of 12. I was very lucky. I think it was Duane Eddy was the first guitar piece I ever heard. And my friend had a guitar, and I managed to figure out how to play this basic line of Duane Eddy's, and it sort of got me into, being interested in the guitar, and that's really how it started. My parents got me a cheap guitar when I was 12 years old, and that's where it began, and I started to take lessons. I did some guitar lessons for a couple of years, and then really I got into bands very quickly. So really from about the age of 13 onwards, I was involved in bands.
Oh, okay. And were you in the multiple bands? How did it work for you?
Well, it started off, in the local town where I grew up, and there were a few bands, that I formed, and then, it would go along for a while. We'd form another one, and that went on until I was about 18. And then I joined a band called The Gods, which was a London-based band, and which was sort of a professional band. Up to then, of course, it had just been doing it on a sort of amateur basis. Then I joined The Gods, and I went to live up in London, and from there on, I was with The Gods for about a year. It was one of those bands that a lot of people played for. It was like a musical roundabout. I think Mick Taylor was in it, a few other people. But anyway, I was only in The Gods for a year, and the next band I formed with Robert Fripp was King Crimson. And it was then, really, that I broke out into what I would call the professional sort of music scene.
Right, and how did you transition over to the bass?
It was quite simple. Robert Fripp and I went to the same guitar teacher when we grew up. And we used to play our guitar lessons together. So we were both familiar with each other's playing from children, since we were young kids. And when it came to forming King Crimson, we only needed one guitar player. And so Robert said to me, look, we only need one guitar player in the band, and you're the frontline singer. Do you think you could play bass and let me play lead guitar? And so I said, yeah, I don't mind, because I just thought bass must be easy because there's only four strings instead of six.
Right.
Of course, I didn't realize at the time that bass playing is an art form in and of itself. And I very soon learned that I wasn't quite as clever as I thought, and I had a lot of work to do to actually learn how to play the bass properly.
Wow. So how long do you think it took you to move to the bass and get King Crimson moving along?
I was quite quick because I had the discipline of having Mike Giles, the drummer, behind me all the time, shouting at me.
Nice.
I'll never forget I'll give you a lovely example. When I first played the bass, I was not aware that when you play bass, say you're playing four to the bar, you shouldn't play on the offbeat because that's where the snare drum plays.
Mm.
And, of course, I didn't know that. So I was playing on all four beats. And Mike Giles stopped me one day and he said, listen, man, you don't play on beat two and beat four.
Wow.
And I said, what do you mean? He said, because if you play and I play together, the snare drum doesn't cut through.
Mm.
So there's a little example of where, very simple, it's nothing to do with, difficulty or playing technique, but if you don't know that, you really, the band doesn't sound very good because, you know, you never get this clear snare drum cracking through. So
right.
It's things like that that I had to learn. As a player, I mean, I could fly around very fast on the bass guitar, but it's not, you know, bass playing is a supportive instrument. And you have to learn how to support and how to be a sort of foundation. That's the art in it, really.
Right, to be sort of a foundation and a beat and to kind of anchor the songs.
Yeah. You'll often hear people say it's more about what you don't play, you know, what you leave out. And that example about the snare drum I just gave you is a wonderful example of really what, it sounds better when you don't play.
Wow.
And so a lot of it is about what you shouldn't play. But, you know, it's an everlasting lesson, really. I'm always learning. I still learn to this day things about playing the bass, you know.
Wow, certainly. So you made this cosmic switch to the bass. You were, you know, a great guitar player, but a somewhat newbie to the bass and had all the not only nuances to learn, but some of the basic things, as you just detailed for us. So
yes.
When King Crimson starts to move a little bit, were you writing as far as their first effort? And how long did it take to produce it?
By the time I'd got to King Crimson, the idea, the concept of writing had really become essential. And also, you know, as I said, because Robert and I had grown up together, we knew each other from a musical standpoint. We understood each other. We understood the roots of where we came from.
Right.
And so King Crimson had two advantages, really. One, that Robert and I were intimately familiar with each other's musical roots. And secondly, that we had a kind of different sound because I played the bass in a way that was halfway. It was kind of halfway between a guitar style and a bass style. When I first picked up the bass, it had tape wound strings on, which were very dull, you know. And I was used to the sustain of a guitar. And I was very frustrated with the bass, you know, not having enough sustain. And I discovered these wire-wound strings one day, which gave me the ability to play more like a guitar would play, with long, sustained notes. And therefore, King Crimson had a different sound to most other rock bands up to that time.
Right, certainly, that's true. How long did it take between... you're getting together for King Crimson and getting your bass playing moving and writing their first album, The Court of the Crimson King?
Oh, very quick. I mean, you're talking literally months, you know, a couple of months.
Wow. Wow, what a short period of time.
I mean, you know, the record itself is, as I say, from a bass playing standpoint, I could play the bass very fast, you know. It was just a question of learning how to play it tastefully. That was the problem, is learning how to use it tastefully. And as I say, I received a lot of help from Mike, the drummer, and I worked hard. You know, I learned on the fly. I think that's the expression.
Wow.
but as I say, it was, you know. At least I didn't have to learn how to play the instrument. I could play. I was quite dexterous on it. I was quite quick on it and nimble. But, as I say, it was a question of learning, really, the application. And but, you know, once I started to understand how it works and the role I should be playing,
right,
it kind of all fell into place pretty quick.
Right. So relatively a short period of time... months, you know, you're coming into a new instrument, you're with a new band, you're, you know, writing, and I don't know if you were involved in production at the time, but how did The Court of the Crimson King come together for you?
Well, it was an album that was made, you know, immediately King Crimson formed, and we got the whole band assembled. We pretty much started writing the album. And perhaps a month later, we started recording it. Things moved very quickly for King Crimson. It was one of those situations which at the time was, I think the right word would be, it was quite explosive. People would hear us and they would be shocked because it was so different. You know, for a start, you see, most bands, most rock bands up until that time in the UK that had taken their influence from American music, from blues and country and western and jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And King Crimson really took its influences from European music, classical music, some from European folk music. You know, Robert and I had grown up on European music. And so our rock music was more, had more of a European heritage.
Right, so it was considerably different from all of the other sincerest form of flattery things.
The other thing about it was the lineup of the band was different too, because Ian MacDonald played flute, and that, before King Crimson, was a very unusual instrument to have it in a band.
Right.
Also, the Mellotron. We were one of the first bands to use Mellotron. And so, you know, all of a sudden we had this symphonic element to the band. And because Robert and I were both quite accomplished guitar players, you had, you know, some very nippy playing, things like Schizoid Man, where it had this blindingly fast solo in it, which, you know, people just couldn't believe that we were playing that fast. And the band generally was a shock. It shocked people.
Wow. Well, it certainly was an eye-opener for me in my youth as well to hear the guitar and how punctuated, I guess, it was. And like you said, the bass solo was quite fast, and the vocals, which were somewhat loud and distorted, but on purpose. What was the meaning behind that?
On Schizoid Man,
yeah.
the whole idea was for it to be a really just a frightening assault on the senses. You know, that was the artistic intent behind it.
Right.
That's why it's so percussive and intense. So the whole thing was to convey this frightening intensity, which is also reflected in the lyrics.
Right, right. And in The Court of the Crimson King, the title track, which is very different from that.
It is very symphonic, and it's, you know, it's sort of fantasy based, really. There's sort of all the way through King Crimson, and in fact all the way through all of my life, the lyrics have been, I've tried to write lyrics that were different, and at that time I was writing with Pete Sinfield. And we would, you know, the whole idea really was to try and be original and to try and create things which had not been done before.
Right, and you successfully did that.
You know, we were always trying to be different in that sense.
Right, and you certainly were all of that. So the whirlwind of King Crimson came along and knocked people off their feet, and all of a sudden your meteoric rise was starting, and I guess, as the story goes, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you were backstage touring with King Crimson, and then the world was just opening up to you, and your other friend, Keith Emerson, of The Nice, who was, I guess, playing on your tours and kind of supporting you, came backstage and said, "Hey, let's start a new band with Carl Palmer of Atomic Rooster." Would that conversation actually take place? It must have.
Well, what actually happened was King Crimson were on tour in America, and Ian MacDonald and Mike Giles, two of the members of the band, they didn't really enjoy the touring. They didn't like flying, and they didn't like the whole hectic life on the road, really. And they decided to they didn't want to tour anymore, and they decided to go off and make an album together, and that was that. So really, King Crimson had come to an end.
Wow.
And it just so happened we were playing at the Fillmore West in San Francisco. And on the bill, the same night as King Crimson, was The Nice, which was the band that Keith had formed.
Right.
And so, you know, we both played. And coincidentally, we were staying at the same hotel.
Hmm.
So after the show, we both went back to the hotel, and we met up in the bar afterwards. And we just started chatting, you know, and I said to Keith, how are you doing, you know? And it went on, and he asked me how I was going and how King Crimson was doing. And I told him, you know, that the band was breaking up and, you know,
wow.
I was maybe looking to do something else. And he said, well, he said, you know, I've really done as much as I can with The Nice. Maybe we should think about forming a band together. And that was where it started.
Wow.
And then we went back to England, and at that time it was just Keith and myself, and we decided then to look for a drummer. And the first person we talked to was Mitch Mitchell from Jimi Hendrix.
Right, from The Experience, sure.
Yeah, and at one time we had planned to get together with Mitch and with Jimmy for a jam, you know, because Jimmy had just finished with The Experience, and he was really messing around with this thing, the band of Gypsies at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he got I think he was just looking to do something different.
Wow.
But anyway, in the meantime, we came across Carl Palmer, and once we played together, we just the chemistry seemed right. And
right.
So we decided to go with Carl, and there it was. Emerson, Lake & Palmer was formed.
Yeah, what a great story. My brother and I have seen Carl several times, and yourself several times. And my brother, I think, has the quote on your colleague Carl Palmer. He said he beats drums harder than any drummer in the universe.
Well, yeah, I mean, Carl's got a very a wonderful technique. He's a very fast player, very, very skillful. And so he plays with a lot of energy and a lot of technique. Very impressive to watch.
Yeah, it's very, very enjoyable to see each of you doing your thing. So you got together and you said, hey, let's do this new thing. And unfortunately, the big thing that was King Crimson was now the big thing that isn't. And I guess that's been their track record ever since. They are and they're not. They are and they're not.
I think the first version of King Crimson had a chemistry which was completely... it was just fortuitous. It was, you know, it wasn't that we were so clever or even so good. We were just lucky to have that chemistry. And as I told you, the band was shockingly good. And we never did any promotion. You know, the first week the band was playing live, we only had like 100 or 150 people would come along and watch us. 2 weeks later, we had 500 people. 2 weeks after that, we had 2,000 people.
Wow.
It went by word of mouth. It spread like wildfire, and it was like having a following wind, you know. We didn't do anything.
Sure.
The band just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and it was just like riding on the crest of a wave, you know, very, very strange feeling.
And what had happened when you had formed ELP and you had just come off of that experience and now you're I guess sort of out on a limb? Fortunately, you were out with other talented players on this limb, but how did all that go for the first album?
You know, the thing about forming ELP was quite strange because it was rather like being the son of a rich and famous father. You know, we'd come, both Keith and I at least, had come from well-known bands. And in a way, I think there was this feeling that we'd somehow been born with a silver spoon in our mouth, you know.
Right.
The truth was that both Keith and I had paid our dues as young men, as kids, really. We'd slept in the back of the vans and we toured all over England for many, many years, you know, starving and basically living on the breadline, long before ELP. So by the time ELP was formed, well, Keith and I had been doing it for 10 years. But for some people, for most people in the public, that was the first time they saw us. And it just looked as though one minute we weren't there, and the next day we were huge.
Right, so you were...
And really, the reason for that was we played on this festival at the Isle of Wight in the south of England. And it was one of the big original festivals like Woodstock. And on the festival was Bob Dylan, The Who, everybody you could think of, really. And it was ELP's debut. And we were the stunner of the festival, you know. On we came, and it was a brand new band, and people loved it. And it was, you know, the next day we were all across the newspapers.
Right. Well, I guess you were probably the first band of the time to be called a super group. That is to say, the members came from other accomplished places and fused and melded and made something new.
That was the first time that word was actually used, was about ELP. And I mean, it's not something we wanted or liked. We, you know,
right.
To be honest, we could have done without it. It really wasn't something we wanted to be associated with. But that was the truth. You know, we had come from these well-known bands, and so there it was. But you know, on the other hand, anybody that knew about us knew the truth. And I think the other thing was that when we played, you could feel it and you could hear it in the music. You know, we weren't toffs that had just slid into the position. You know, we were rock and roll. We knew how to play rock and roll, and so there's no mistaking that. When you hear a really dedicated, honest rock musician, you know it. You know?
Certainly. And the album Emerson, Lake and Palmer was a terrific progressive rock album. It had bass things, drum things, guitar things, keyboard things that have never been seen or heard from since. I mean, except in, of course, your guys' careers, that is. And there was Lucky Man, and it was totally different and unique and soft. What's the story of Lucky Man?
Lucky Man is a song that I actually wrote when I first got a guitar. When I was 12 years old, the first chords I learned were D, G, A minor, E minor, these few simple basic chords. And as soon as I'd learned them, I wrote this little song, you know, just to amuse myself. And I never even wrote it down on a piece of paper, but for some reason, I just remembered it. It was one of those things, I just remembered it. And it was many years later, we were in the studio doing the first ELP album. And we'd in those days, it was actually a vinyl album. And it had to be, I think, 19 minutes or 21 minutes per side, or as near as damn it. Turns out that we were one song short when we'd come to the end of our studio time. And everybody looked around the studio, you know, has anybody got any ideas, you know, for this last song? And there was a deathly silence. Mm. You know, nobody had any more material written. And I said, well, look, we've got to have something. I said, I wrote this little folk song when I was a kid. Maybe we could do that. At least it would be, you know, be unusual or something that would, you know, at least fill up the last track. And I played it to Keith and Carl, and Keith didn't really, he just couldn't see how it would work with the LP because it was nothing like anything else that we'd done. Anyway, there was nothing else to record. So Carl and I got down, and we cut the track just with an acoustic guitar and drum kit. And Keith went off down the pub. He just, you know, he sort of abandoned it at that point.
Right.
And Carl and I recorded the first two passes, and then I put on a bass guitar, and it actually didn't. It sounded better then, you know. And then I put on another acoustic, so we had a double-tracked acoustic, bass and drums. And then I put on all the voices, all the harmonies, the electric guitar parts. And by that time, it started to sound like, well, it, like it does now. It was the record. It was the completed record. And when Keith came back to the studio, he was shocked, you know, because he'd left hearing this sort of plaintive little folk song on acoustic guitar. And when he came back, it was completed recording.
I see.
So he said, wow, you know, that's great. And he said, but maybe I should play on it, you know. So I said, you know, he had just taken delivery of this Moog synthesizer, which at that time was completely revolutionary, you know. And he had this thing out in the studio. They just delivered it. So he said, why don't I try something on this new gadget that they've just delivered? So he went out in the studio and he started to experiment with it. And as we played the end of the track, he was experimenting with the portmanteau, which was, you know, it's where one note swoops up to another and swoops down to another. And you get this sort of swooping effect. And he was just experimenting with that to see how long it would take to get from one note to the other. And as luck would have it, as he was rehearsing, I pressed the record button. And we took the solo that he was rehearsing. And at the end of the song, when the thing had finished, the engineer looked at me and he said, is it my imagination or did that sound good? I said, I don't know, just play it again. And so we played it back in the control room, and that's the solo that you now hear on the album.
Yeah, it's an incredible piece of work, and anybody who's heard it with any regularity, I mean, I can actually hear it playing in my head. It was so unique and somewhat out of place with the song, but it was just so unique that you can't forget it.
It was totally thoughtless.
Yeah.
And Keith had just played through with this sort of experimental fluidity, not thinking about the notes, really. And that was what was so beautiful about it. It wasn't contrived. It was just right off the cuff. In fact, I pressed the talk back and I said, Keith, you should come in and listen to what you've just played. And at first he didn't want to come in. He was saying, no. He said, I could do a much better one than that. I'll do it, you know. And the thing was that in those days, there was only 16 tracks to record on.
Right.
And so there were no more tracks. So for him to do another take, we would have had to erase the one we had.
Oh, no.
So I said, Keith, you've got to come in and hear it. And no, I could do a much better one, you know. So eventually I had to go out in the studio and plead with him, Keith, please come in and listen to this recording. It's really good, and you'll regret it if you lose it. So he came in, and of course, when he heard it played back, it was the solo we hear, and it was fantastic, and that was that.
Very, very fortunately,
we didn't have any thought of it being any sort of big hit song or anything that would be, you know, living on as it has done. It was just, you know, we thought it was just a nice track that would fill the album up.
Right, but it certainly took on a life of its own, and it was probably your first single over here, I would say.
Yes, that's right. I mean, luckily, it was really the great thing about Lucky Man was that it got onto the radio and it introduced the band to a lot of people that would have otherwise either not heard us or would have taken a very long time to get to hear us.
Certainly. And then, you know, you've got several albums between that time and now, Pictures at an Exhibition, Tarkus Trilogy, and Brain Salad Surgery is one that also stands out to me, single-wise, as far as Carnival 9, Second Impression. Can you tell us about that? Because that's something that stands out for us.
You know, the basic idea behind that album was Welcome Back, My Friends, to the Show That Never Ends. It was a It was this, it was like an imaginary carnival where things would be paraded in front of your eyes, you know. And it was rather like this circus element. We had decided that the album before that was Trilogy. The studio album before that was Trilogy, which is an album I really like a lot by ELP because it was really innovative. But the problem with it was that we did a lot of overdubbing. And when it came to playing live, we had a lot of trouble playing the things because, you know, we're only a three-piece band. And on some of these tracks, we'd put 25, 30 instruments.
Well.
So we decided that on the next album, we would make sure that nothing went on the record that we couldn't play live. In other words, anything that was on the album, we could play live. And what we did was, we actually, these were the days of extravagance, of course, we actually bought a cinema to rehearse in so that we could practice playing on stage live as we developed the album. And that's how we did it. We went into this cinema, we created the album, we performed it, you know, to nobody in this empty theater until it was a completed album, and then we recorded it. And that was how that came about. And it was a kind of it was a fantasy record in a way, but there are messages in it, and one of them was really about how, and you have to imagine when that was made, how long was that? 40 years ago. 40 years ago, there weren't even faxes, let alone emails, right? So it's hard for you to imagine that because you're so young. But if you can imagine a time before there were mobile phones, a time before there was even faxes or emails, the song Carnival 9 was talking about how computers would come to dominate our lives.
Who knew?
And there is this line in there which says, load your program, I am yourself.
Wow.
Which now when you look back on it, is actually quite prophetic, you know. It was looking into the future and saying, computers are going to come to dominate our lives. And that maybe we had imagined it rather like that Metropolis film that was made in the early 1920s.
Right.
You know, where the whole world would become a load of automatons. Well, you know, I'm not sure that that was the you know, that's obviously not what's happened. But computers have come to dominate our lives in a remarkable way.
Certainly.
I mean, you don't move without, you know, looking it up in Google, do you? You know what I'm saying?
No, fortunately, and that's how, you know, we arranged through for this interview was through the magic of computers, and I appreciate you taking your time today. In the last few minutes, it was interesting with your, as ELP had finished up a few albums later, that you had actually come to Asia and play at the famous Asia in Asia video concert in Tokyo, standing in for John Wetton, who wound up replacing you in, you know, the former band.
I know. Well, John and I, of course, come from a similar place in England. We actually grew up in the same town, funnily enough. And so, you know, we were friends, John and I. We'd known each other for many years. And so it was Carl Palmer who called me up one day, and he said, he said, Greg, I wonder if you could do me a favor. I thought he wanted to borrow a guitar, you know. I said,
right.
Sure, what do you want? And he said, oh, man, he said, you've got to come and do a gig for us in Tokyo. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, you know, we've just fallen out with John, and he's left the band, and we're committed to doing this tour in Japan. So I said, whoa, you know. I said, well, when is it? And he said, next week.
Wow, that's amazing.
I said, I don't know any of the songs. I can't play them next week. He said, no, you got to, man, because He said, we booked this 747 jet, and we're flying all these people down. They ran a competition on MTV, and they gave away all these plane tickets to fly the fans down to Tokyo to see the show. And so that was all booked up. The Budokan was booked up in Tokyo. The whole satellite broadcast was booked up, and it was going to be a disaster. So in the end, I agreed to do it. And I had to have lyric prompters, and I had to learn this stuff in a week. I mean, it was a nightmare.
Oh, well, it came off well, if that's any consolation.
Yeah, I got away with it. But,
right.
But it was not something that I would like to do again, I have to say.
Well, in the last moment or two, can you just tell us about what's going on now and what the future may hold for Greg Lake?
Right now, I am songwriting and I'm recording. I want to put together another album, but I do want to go back out on the road, and I'm currently negotiating a really exciting tour, which unfortunately I can't tell you about because it's not confirmed. But very soon, I think probably early next year, I'll be back out on the road and with a new record, and that's really that's what I'm about now.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Greg, for an excellent career in music and for being a wonderful people person in touch with your fans and making yourself available today. We're mighty grateful. Thank you.
That's my pleasure.
This has been Craig Wax for Rowan Radio, 89.7 WGLS-FM, with our special Lucky Man interview with Greg Lake of Emerson, Lake & Palmer. Thank you.